Commerce Podcast. It's the first episode. My name is Amr Grigic, and with me today is Sohan Maheshwar. Sohan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Amr. Honored to be the first guest on the show.
Yeah, and I couldn't have asked for a better guest. I can tell you. Could you let's just start off with just an introduction of yourself. Could you tell everybody about yourself, but also your background?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Sohan. I work in dev relations and have been so in the last more than 10 years, actually. I'm currently lead dev advocate at a startup called AuthZ. We do authorization at scale. I come from a background of working in the cloud. I was with Amazon and AWS for 6 years, worked for companies like Fermion and Gupshop as well. Again, all in the dev relations space. So yeah, happy to be here.
Cool. You alluded to it a little bit, your current role. Could you tell a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I work for AuthZ. We are essentially an authorization product. We're built around this open source thing called SpiceDB, which it's a database for all your permissions needs, right? And it's based on the Google Zanzibar paper, which is how Google essentially does its authorization internally across like Docs and Cloud and YouTube and things like that. So yeah, that's what we do. And we have a pretty thriving dev community. So that's what I look at.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the developer relations space with you because, of course, you, as you said, you've been working in that for 10 years. Could you kind of describe what developer relations is and also how it bridges maybe the gap between developers and product teams and those kind of things? Could you tell a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think when I'm asked to sort of describe my role, the one-liner or the elevator pitch that I go with is, my job is to be responsible that the devs using our product are successful, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever it takes for the people using my very technical product or my company's very technical product should be successful. Now, that could mean different things in different companies based on like scale and product and all of that. But fundamentally, that's how I see the role. And I think dev relations is unique and I really like it because it sits somewhere between product, it sits somewhere between like engineering and marketing, right? It's somewhere in between. It's not one of each of these, of course, but it's somewhere in between. And I think the companies and the businesses that do DevRel well sort of understand the balance of these three that go into dev relations. So, you know, I think, that's how I would describe it.
Yeah. And you mentioned it a little bit with the engineering and the marketing side of things. What kind of skills do you really need for being a developer advocate or whatever you want to call it? Because I can imagine that it's not just being able to speak well or being very technical, right? So what would you say about that?
Yeah. I've thought long and hard about this because a lot of people ask me about, you know, hey, what is the thing that I need to get into DevRel? Honestly, I think the first or like maybe the zeroth skill or the most important thing that you need is to have dev empathy, right? Is to have empathy towards what your final audience are actually going through on a day-to-day basis. Because you might be the best speaker or like, I know, the best YouTuber or whatever, but if you don't have that dev empathy, you might not be as successful as like a dev advocate or someone in dev relations. You know, you just end up being a person doing content. So I think having that dev empathy is the first thing that comes through. And I think then everything else comes through, right? I think the ability to explain technical concepts or in any form, right? It could be YouTube, it could be like a sample app, it could be TikTok, written word, but the ability to break down something that's complex, that's technical, and something that you're excited about and get other people excited about it, I think is, you know, the next big skill to sort of do that. And a lot of people also talk about the aspect of community building and things, which I think sort of organically comes through when you're good at, you know, being excited about something and sharing it with a bunch of people. So, yeah.
And do you, when you look at, for example, people that do get in the same role that you do, is that usually people that were just developers and then transitioned into sharing more, or does that also kind of change over from person to person, I can imagine?
To be honest, I think the ones who have been successful in this role are the ones who have had that journey where they've done something technical, like be a developer or a software engineer, or even like CTO, VP of engineering, and then move to DevRel. And the only reason, again, is you go through that journey of experiencing what it is like to be a dev in, you know, like a large enterprise with like all of these constraints of what you can use and what you can do. And then you build that empathy, and then, you know, your the content you produce is very in tune with what millions of other people are going through, you know. Yeah. So I think the ones who are successful go through that journey. That's not to say that, you know, if you don't go through that journey, you can't be a good DevRel person. But it's an easier sort of evolution, I think. I started my career as a dev as well. You know, I spent like 3.5-4 years like writing Objective-C. Okay, I don't know if people remember that, but writing iOS apps back in the day. I think I'm dating myself right now, but yeah.
When you were a developer and go and switching to this role, what was that like? Because I can imagine that it's not that easy to be a developer, just code and do your thing, and then being having to share about that and those kind of things. So how was that transition for you?
Yeah, I think, so again, this was in the early 2010s, and I was writing iOS apps, for a company, and there wasn't as much information as there is right now, you know, in terms of like YouTube videos and ChatGPT and all of that. Info was sparse. And so I started sharing, some of the learnings that I had, or like small hacky things that we came across like on a company blog. And then I got super active on Stack Overflow. And I realized, hey, this fake internet points thing is very addictive. I want more points. I want more karma on Stack Overflow. So, you know, you start answering questions and things like that. And you come to that realization that, you know, I really like coding. I really like tech, but I also like the things around it, you know, being able to share info, answer people's questions on Stack Overflow, blog, tweet a little bit, you know, before it was called X. So I think having that realization of, if there is a role which allows me to be in tech, do some coding, but also all these other things, that would like sort of be my dream job, you know. And DevRel was just sort of taking off then, and I was lucky enough to get an opportunity, and you know, I've been in DevRel ever since.
And it, was it because a part of being in developer relations is also public speaking, usually kind of, there is a kind of stigma that, of course, developers are not that great at at public speaking. Was that also something that you had to kind of, did it come natural to you, like the public speaking, or was it more like something that you also had to develop?
Oh, the latter for sure. I'm actually like, I started off being a very shy person, would be terrified to speak in public. Like even in school, I never did debate and elocution and things, you know. I'd prefer the more like backstage sort of like help out, that sort of thing. So it was 100% just like a practice, like screw up the first few times, listen to people who do it well, and, you know, get like tips from them. And yeah, just try and get better at it. So at least, having done that for a while now, I'm comfortable enough to like go on stage right now and speak in front of like large audiences. But it was something I 100% had to work on and develop. And yeah. I think anyone can is, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important, actually, that particular part. I think people sometimes look at public speaking as something that's natural to people. Like it's natural that someone is a good public speaker. If I look at my own kind of journey, and to be frank, I hated being on stage. I hated being on stage talking in front of people. But then it is something that you can practice. And the first few times, as you said, you will probably not be as good as you would like. But then the more you do it, the more you kind of figure out some kind of tips and tricks, some small things that that help you to make it easier. I think then it becomes like an easier thing. And also you calm yourself a little bit on, but I get nervous even when I have to go on stage still. It's not something that that goes away, but it is less and less. Figure out what.
And I've seen you do so many talks, Amar, like in public. I mean, Amar and myself, we work together. But I could never tell that you were nervous, right? You seem like a natural on stage. So, you know, I think it's that muscle memory with any skill in the world, really. It's about like practicing, and, you know, getting like the right tips or learning and then implementing what you've learned. And I'm sure like rock stars like the Rolling Stones have played whatever millions of shows, I still feel like a bit of like nervous excitement before going on stage, right? And happens to everyone. So yeah, you just got to do it.
What are some maybe tips or tricks you would share with people that want to get better at this?
Yeah, I think two tips sort of helped me with public speaking, right? So one is my manager when I was in the Alexa team, Paul Kotzinger, really good public speaker, right? And one thing he said was we all tend to sort of overthink that, oh, I have to hit all of these notes and mention every bullet point on my slide. And we end up overthinking things. Whereas if you just go on stage, get your point across, but have fun, have energy, have excitement, and be excited about talking, the audience will enjoy it and they'll take some message back, right? And I think the key thing for me there was, yeah, it's fine if they don't remember 100% of every word I said, but if they take like the key messages back through my excitement and energy, that's good, you know? So that sort of helped. And the second one was, and I think this is something that I have sort of passed along to other people as well. The big problem with speaking on stage is you're alone on this big, you know, stage, and there are lights and there are people in front of you. It's a very evolutionary thing to be nervous when you see lots of people facing you. You know, something's kicking, right? From like millions of years ago. I think being comfortable with a bit of silence on stage is the superpower, right? We don't want that silence on stage because we think, oh man, everyone's looking at me right now. It's all silent. So you end up like talking really fast, which leads to, you know, you missing out, I know, words, having like ums and ahs in your sentences. But the only person who thinks you're going, you know, too slow is yourself. And those silences can actually lead to people listening to you more. It's not something super monotonous. So the question I think there is then, okay, how do I get comfortable with being silent on stage? And the easiest hack, and I do this all the time, before I start my first, like, hi, welcome to this talk, I take a long breath, I smile, and I start, you know? And again, whatever evolutionary sort of like body reaction, it helps me calm down. It helps me be okay with silence on stage. And then I just go.
That's a good one. I do that too. It's actually I did a first level management course a long time ago, and one of the things that the person that was leading the workshop, we had to present as well. We had to stand up in front of the group and present about something, and she told me the same thing actually. She was like, "Why are you so? Are you in a hurry, or what's going on?" Like, and you saw some other people also just walking up to the stage and already kind of dismissing themselves, like kind of saying like, "Oh yeah, I didn't prepare this much," or "I hope my slides work," or those kind of things, kind of making yourself more nervous. And then also, she said like, "Why not just walk up to the stage, stand up?" Stand where the stage is and then have a smile. Wait for everybody to kind of calm down and they really are facing you and looking at you. And then start. Like, otherwise, people will maybe not even hear the first 20 seconds of your talk. Like, those kind of things are important. And one other thing that helped me actually is I do like a breathing exercise usually before I go and have any talk actually on stage. Just to further calm me down. It's like a extra kind of way to get myself in the zone of, okay, I'm gonna deliver this talk. I know what I'm talking about. It's not like something that, and if something goes wrong, which it can, it goes wrong. Acknowledge it and move past it. That's kind of the thing. So is that the one thing that you do while just pausing and before, is that kind of the only thing that you do before you actually prepare the talk? Of course, you look at the content, but is there other things that you do to get yourself prepared?
I mean, I think there are lots of tips about like crafting like a nice story and being technical and not doing a vendor pitch and stuff, you know, that I think is essential to tell like a good story. And I think those things, you know, are tips that are things that people know and typically do, and sometimes you might do a slightly better job or a slightly worse job. The other sort of tip that I give people, and I also like to imbibe and keep as like a guiding light, is to try and be my authentic self. You know, it's okay to be inspired by other people's way of presenting, but my personality has to come out in the talk. You know, I am a little like, this is how I talk on stage as well. I'm a little understated, that sort of thing. I'm not like running around, jumping around.
You're laid back.
Yeah, a little laid back. You know, that is my style, right? I'm not going to try and ape someone else's style and come across as inauthentic, especially in this role. One thing people have to know, that the developer is a very discerning audience. You know, they're not going to fall for things that are fake or marketing. They need something authentic. And as a developer, you understand that that's the dev empathy. So I have to be my authentic self on stage as well. So,
yeah, I can imagine it's also the way you talk. I've seen a lot of presentations in my day. And whenever I had the feeling that someone was reading something or just trying to get some messaging across or those kind of things, you instantly just pick up on
switch
that.
Off.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, this is going to be a marketing talk.
Yeah.
And this is not something that I'm interested in. But when you hear like actual stories of someone going through like I think developers and engineers in general can relate to that, because they maybe went through the same thing, or they didn't, right? It depends. Yeah. And then that's another thing I think is very important. And one tip actually you gave me, it's a while back, but...
A while back, okay.
I still kind of keep it, is kind of whenever you start to talk, start high. Like start high in terms of your tone,
yeah.
Because then your energy level and the way you talk kind of raises with that throughout the talk. And I still use that. So thank you for that.
Someone else passed that along to me. You know, I just, it helped me as well. And you also then automatically get like voice modulation. You start high, and then even when you go to like your normal tone, there is voice modulation. So people's attention are not, you know, they have your attention. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's super easy kind of a little hack, but it really, really does wonders. To get back to the kind of developer relations space as well. So what is typically being looked at, for example, from a metrics perspective, right, or KPIs. So how do you kind of measure your success as a developer relations or developer advocate?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question, I think. Honestly, if you do like any dev relations meetups, conferences, everyone's talking about this. And the simple reason is there is no easy answer for this. You know, there isn't like it's not like a sales thing where you're like, oh, revenue, pipeline, you know, you're done. How I like to look at it is three ways. The first one is you can look at it as input goals, right? Where you say, hey, I will do like this 5 pieces of content per month, per week, whatever. And if we do that, we know, you know, we're putting out enough out there, etc. And the reason why this is only an input goal is like, say you write an article for like a TechCrunch, they're not going to give you how many people viewed it in which geographies. You have to just hope that it's reaching the right audience, whatever, right? So there are avenues like that. The second is output goals. So sometimes you create content or you reach people and you know how many people you've reached, like X number of views on YouTube or like 3,000 people at a conference or whatever. Both these things aren't hard metrics, but they can be indicators. You know, sometimes I know having like 1.5 million views like on an Insta reel is very, very top of funnel. So you don't know how that connects to, you know, your product, which brings me to my third metric, which is, I think it's important to have what is the goal of DevRel for your organization or your company. You know, for some people, it could be like product adoption. For some people, it could be metrics. For some people, it could be community. The one thing that is most important. And a way to you have to figure out how all of these things that you do, how that ties in to that one goal. Now, again, this is not a perfect metric, right? Because two examples, you can speak at a conference, 10 people in the room, and you're like, yeah, whatever, 10 people. But maybe all 10 of those people went, used your product, did something amazing, and you have no way to attribute it. Conversely, you can speak to a room of like, I don't know, 3,000 people, and absolutely no one looks at your product again. So it's not a hard metric. There's a lot of correlation, causation type things. What it is an indicator. If you're trending the right way, that means you know what you're doing has some impact. And that's important because it's so hard sometimes for DevRel to show like impact in an organization, right? And lots of companies, especially when there's like this economic, like, you know, uncertainty and things, look at functions which are not giving you immediate like revenue or impact. And they're like, hey, what are y'all doing? You know? So at least I like to look at it in these three ways for DevRel.
It's easier for like someone from sales to say like, hey, I had the impact on the revenue here. You can see it. Like it's, it's harder to, as you said, like when someone has, for example, you do a talk somewhere, right? How do you know if those people that were in the room actually went and actually tested your product and those kind of things? There's this other thing of the quality of your content. We usually use that, use things like CSAT for that and those kind of things. What are your views on doing that? Because I can, to me, it always is a little bit subjective. It's not really an objective metric, right? It's how people feel about what you did. Do you still use those kind of metrics as well? Or is that something that that's less used now?
At least in all the orgs I've worked in, I think it's less used. And in AWS, we use that as a metric when we tracked all the content that we created, which had CSATs. But that was more just like a, hey, my CSATs are really low, so I need to improve on something or the way I'm doing something. Or, you know, this person's CSATs are super high. They're doing like a phenomenal job. So they're doing something right. So, you know, maybe there's something we can learn. But we never use that as a hard metric to, you know, sort of quantify success. Because like you said, it is very subjective. It is very CSATs. I think we had so many conversations because in like, say, one region in Europe, CSATs were consistently low, even though you had the best speakers out there, because culturally no one would give like a 5-on-5. When you go towards Asia, you would get CSATs, you know, like always 5-on-5, because people are very like generous towards, you know, giving like that 5-star rating. So it's such a like, you know, cultural thing as well. And we always had these discussions about it, which is why, you know, it's not a success metric for me.
Yeah. And I think that's true. And also what you often see is that, for example, even if you have a crowd of like 500 people, like that comes to a talk, usually it will be just a small subset that is actually going to fill in the survey as well. Like, what can you really discern from that if like 50 people out of 500 filled it in, right? Yep. What did the other 450 think? You don't know. you have no idea. Those are also kind of things that I feel like it's a good indicator in most cases, but it's not like the end all be all for everything, right? That's the kind of thing.
I think few conferences, including reInvent, have tried different ways to actually do this elegantly. So one is if you have a large enough conference with an app that people are checking often, you know, once you enter a session, you're scanned. So you're badged in. And when you're exiting, once the session's done, you get a notification saying, what do you think? So it's more recent. Some conferences have the airport style, like three buttons about like good, neutral, bad, where you just press it near the door. I went to this one conference which basically said, we'll give you conference swag at the end of the conference once you fill in feedback. So they got like three conference t-shirts. The feedback was through the roof. You know, everyone's like 5-on-5, give me my free t-shirt. So there are good and bad ways to do it.
There's if you put incentives on it, people will fill it in. Yes, that's correct. So one other thing I was wondering about, because you, of course, the kind of technological advancements are just progressing. It's not never stopping. So how do you kind of stay up to date? How do you kind of create content that is relevant to what's going on right now in the world?
Yeah, I think one is acknowledging that, yes, things are moving super fast. I think DevRel is uniquely positioned in an org of any size, like from like a 10-person startup to something the size of Amazon, is that you are the ones with the ear on the ground speaking to other developers. And in those conversations, you get to hear what, you know, the latest tech is, or what the latest adoption curve for different tech is. And that influences your sample apps, your demos, and so on, right? So for instance, say I'm demoing like a product, I have to look at the tech stack around it that most of my audience is moving towards, you know? So having that ear on the ground, I think, is super important for any DevRel, and that should inform your content creation and maybe even your product, you know, where you're like, hey, look, 90% of our devs use this particular database. We don't support it. So maybe it's time, you know, our product engineering takes a look at how we can support it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's not just pushing your product, like showing what it can do and those kind of things, but it's also kind of valuable feedback to you, like, hey, our product is missing this. From every kind of conversation that I have, these are things that need to change as well. And that's, I think, sometimes maybe less highlighted is how you impact the product in the end. I think that's something that we usually we think about developer relations as a kind of a push kind of thing, like you send information into the world, but you get information back too.
I think
that's something that gets less highlighted, let's put it like that.
And honestly, I think it's one of the underrated aspects of DevRel, especially in smaller orgs. You have that immediate impact right there, where you're going out to the meetup or you're spending time on a Discord group, you're hearing all of this and you're passing that back on to your engineering and product team. So that loop is there. At AWS, it was a lot harder because the org is so big and there are people doing user research, but we still had a mechanism to do this. So there was an internal site that any AWS employee could access, but anything you'd hear from the community, we'd put it there. We'd put it on our DevRel team Slack group so that, you know, other people can chime in, pun unintended. And so even at a company the size of AWS, there was that mechanism to feed this or to give this feedback, you know, back to the product and service teams.
And you mentioned about like thinking about your audience as well when you speak. If you, for example, in your current role, you talk about a particular product, does it also mean that whenever you do a talk for a different conference or a different space, that you also kind of tune your presentation to that?
Yeah, always. Honestly, this is something I picked up at Amazon, which is the whole customer obsession leadership principle, which again is not just like a sales thing of like, I have to sell to the most customers or something, right? It's about knowing your audience, knowing what excites them. So every time I apply to a CFP for a conference or get an invite for a conference, the first question I ask is, can you tell me a bit about the audience? You know, because you don't want to be talking at a level and your audience is at a different level, either up or down both ways. Or maybe this audience are a bunch of like front-end engineers and you're talking about something, you know, that's very back-end specific. So you really have to tune your talk so that you get to that that audience. And again, this is where like the storytelling and all of it comes into picture as well. Sometimes it's just hard because you go in a little blind, not knowing where the audience is. And, you know, I've actually heard like Kelsey Hightower speak about how he sort of gets that gauge by just feeling the audience when he's on stage, you know. And he was telling me, we were at a speaker dinner at a conference, and he was telling us rather that the minute he's like, he sees someone reach for the phone, you're like, okay, I know I'm losing the crowd there. So you switch onto something that you think will get their attention. So, you know, it's like a DJ at a concert. They're just not hitting like a play button and relaxing. They're sort of feeling the vibe of the crowd and like tuning what they had planned, tuning it to what the crowd's sort of doing. So the really good speakers can do that very well. I don't consider myself like up there to be able to do that well, but I've seen like the good speakers do that.
Yeah, no, me neither, to be fair. I think it takes a lot of being present in the moment, which is hard to do if you already kind of a little bit nervous and those kind of things. But yeah, it's something that that is very important. I had an example as well where someone was presenting in Amsterdam, and they had like a map with like all kinds of different things. It was like a demo, they had all different kinds of places in Europe, but Amsterdam was not on it. And I was like, like you're gonna get like credits if you just make Amsterdam a big focal point on your presentation. Like it's an easy kind of small kind of thing that you can just tweak, and you're gonna get some credits from the audience in that sense.
Yeah.
I have two more questions before I let you go. We talked a little bit about your transition from developer to be in the developer relations space. What are some things you have maybe said to people or that are interested in moving into a role like yours? What are some tips and tricks that you've shared with them, or any advice?
I think the one advice, the first question I ask them is, hey, do you have dev empathy, you know, or have you gone through that journey and are you willing to put yourself through that journey as well to help out your core audience? And turns out some people are like, no, you know what, I just sort of want to be on stage, so maybe this is not for me, or I just want to create content. So, you know, there is a content creator path out there that is super open now without having to be in DevRel. If people say yes, you know, that is something I'm excited about, I just tell them to like sort of hone how they explain tech to people, right? How you understand tech, what tech makes you excited, and how you would put that across for people to understand. The sort of the path that I see many people take, which I don't recommend, is like, oh, I have to be in DevRel, so I need a Twitch streaming account, I need TikTok, I need a blog, I need like all of these different things. And they spread themselves too thin, you know? So I sort of tell them, hey, look, find the one thing that one medium that you enjoy. Maybe you like writing a lot, so just start writing regularly, build that habit, build that muscle. Maybe you like creating videos, so just do that, build that muscle. And, you know, it's one of those things where if you're authentic, you're excited, and you're sharing something that people will like, people will flock to you. So,
I like podcasts,
yeah.
as you might
So
have
exactly,
noticed.
right? Yeah.
And I think that's something that so I usually do these kind of podcasts because I enjoy just talking to people about what they're doing and how they went through a particular journey. Also to kind of figure out like, okay, what are some things that you could have tweaked and saw like along the way? I think this is kind of a medium I'm comfortable with. I like writing too, but it takes so much more effort for me than just doing a public speaking talk or this or so. I think it's a good point. Like, focus on something that you enjoy doing. Because if you say, for instance, you want to you say like, I want to start a blog, but it takes so much effort for you to actually start writing, then you're not gonna keep it up for a longer period of time. That's
Yeah,
kind of the thing.
absolutely, absolutely. And I think the internet gives us this opportunity now to explore all of these different media. You know, maybe like 15 years ago, that might not have been the case. You had to blog, and that was pretty much it, or whatever. Your options were limited. But now there are so many different ways. I mean, I know people who have who just like bringing people together, and they are, you know, like say Microsoft MVPs or AWS heroes, just by organizing meetups. And they're not the most technical people, but they really enjoy like bringing people together, bringing the right speakers, and they do this for the community. You know, they enjoy that community aspect so much. And again, I think that's great. That's amazing. We need people like that, you know. So yeah.
All right. And of course, well, this is going to be the last question every interview, so people get used to it.
Yeah.
If you would have to nominate someone, or you would like to see someone next as a podcast guest, who would that be?
How big can I go? Like,
You can go as big as you want. I cannot
okay.
promise that we get them,
Yeah, okay.
but.
I'm actually I'm a bit of an old soul at times, and I do love a lot of like old computing and stuff. So I'd love to see someone from like a earlier vintage on the podcast that can talk about programming, like say in the late 80s or early 90s. One name that pops up to mind is John Romero, who made Quake and Doom and Dave, who I've got the opportunity to meet once at a book signing. Nicest person, spent like a lot of time talking to people, and he's just super nice and super smart and still codes and still does awesomely cool things. So I'd love to hear someone's perspective from like the good old days of coding, you know, where it was a lot different. So
Let's
yeah.
see. I have this think big principle that I've
Yeah.
never I didn't steal from anybody, I promise. But let's see if we can get going. But I think that would be a very interesting conversation. Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
So on, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amir.